This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Americans headed into battle to the ringing sound of stirring words. Freedom, justice, a war on terror. Down the rabbit hole of memory went America's broken promises in the Middle East, the dubious records of its new best friends, and its own part in the deaths of innocents. Now comes British journalist Robert Fisk to remind us, banging out stories from Beirut, Kandahar, and Jerusalem for a quarter century, fearless, critical stories about the West's misadventures in the Middle East and its missteps right now. His work has won him a slew of journalism awards, but probably few popularity points with world leaders. This hour, Robert Fisk and the history Americans don't want to hear but need to know. First, the latest developments from the Middle East. Israeli troops today pulled out of a West Bank town one day after they killed five people and arrested 10 others. What will it take to get both sides back into a peace process? Earlier today, I spoke with former Maine Senator George Mitchell. Last year, he headed a committee that called for, among other things, an immediate ceasefire in the region and a freeze on construction of Jewish settlements in the West Bank and Gaza. Mitchell has played a role in peace talks in both the Middle East and Ireland. I asked the former senator why he thinks peace is moving ahead in Northern Ireland, but not in Israel.
Well, there hasn't been much good news since September 11th, so the reports out of Northern Ireland are particularly gratifying. It's a very significant step. By no means is it the end of the problems. It isn't going to be all a rosy path ahead. There'll continue to be disputes and difficulties, but I think the people of Northern Ireland have chosen the path of peace and democratic dialogue as a way to resolve their differences. They don't want to return to conflict, and I think a return to large-scale conflict is increasingly unlikely, although, as I said, there'll continue to be some problems, so it's a very heartening thing. In the Middle East, unfortunately, events have gone in the opposite direction, as your question suggested. But even there, I hold out hope. I know I'm in a small minority of those who think that there's some possibility of ending this violence, but I think that, as in Northern Ireland, a weariness with war is setting in. The people on both sides cannot live normal lives. Indeed, I was struck by the fact that on my last visit there, both Prime Minister Sharon and Chairman Arafat, in separate meetings with me, said essentially the same thing. They both said this has got to stop because life has become unbearable for our people.
And yet, it hasn't stopped yet. Just today, Israeli troops withdrew from a West Bank village after a deadly raid that Israel called an anti-terrorist operation and the Palestinian Authority condemned as a massacre. Washington's clearly been trying to calm Israeli-Palestinian violence to hold this Arab support for the anti-terrorism coalition together. How important is peace in this area to the United States now? What are the risks if the situation spirals deeper into violence?
Well, of course, there's the risk of a huge loss of life on both sides, which, from a humanitarian standpoint, would be a terrible tragedy. There's the further risk of it spiraling into a region-wide war, which would be disastrous for the region and for the interests of the United States. And the third risk is that it could undermine the coalition that the United States is building to enable it to prosecute the war that's now going on against terrorism. So I think that there are many risks involved. But I just want to say that at almost any point in time in the several years prior to the date on which an agreement was reached in Northern Ireland, one could have reached a negative conclusion, and many did. I think that what the United States must do is to persevere with a keen sense of urgency on the importance of the problem, but not to be discouraged by setback after setback after setback. You just have to stay with this because you have to recognize that the goal is a good and noble one.
How does the texture of the U.S.-Israel relationship factor in here? That tone in that relationship has clearly changed. On the one hand, President Bush is saying that Israel has no greater friend than the United States. On the other hand, Prime Minister Sharon has ignored demands by the U.S. to pull out of the West Bank. How strained is this friendship?
I don't think there's any meaningful or lasting strain on the relationship. The fact is, of course, that the United States and Israel are both democracies, both sovereign states, and it is inevitable that there are going to be differences of opinion.
But isn't this an awfully difficult moment to have a down phase in the relationship for the United States and for Israel, too?
Well, I think there's no time over the past few decades which wasn't a difficult time. It's obvious that there are just a continuing series of strains and events and crises in the region, and you just can't get too upset about these things, and you have to move forward with steady and patient determination, unperturbed by the difficulties that surround you.
And you don't see higher stakes now of the Arab Islamic world being galvanized against the U.S. as a result of the particular kind of challenge we're looking at?
The Muslim world is not monolithic. There are many varied countries. They have different cultural and linguistic histories.
Mm-hmm.
What they share in common is a growing population, stagnant economies, widespread poverty, and a resort to Islamic fundamentalism. And we have to try to address those fundamental root causes at the same time that we conduct the campaign that we're now engaged in.
Senator Mitchell, with its own hunt on for Osama bin Laden, is the United States going to look the other way as Israel continues with its policy of targeted assassinations?
Well, the United States has not looked the other way. In fact, the President and the Secretary of State and the State Department have repeatedly made clear its view in that regard, and just recently have requested in very strong terms that the government of Israel withdraw its military forces from the Palestinian areas which it's occupied them.
But does it change Washington's position when President Bush has called for Osama dead or alive?
No, I don't think it's changed Washington's position. Not at all.
Senator Mitchell, if you could sit down right now with Prime Minister Sharon and Yasser Arafat, what would you say?
Well, I'd say the same thing to them that I've said to them in our many meetings in the past few months, that history and geography have destined their two peoples to live side by side. There can't be any separation. I mean, those among the Palestinians who think that the state of Israel can be destroyed are simply wrong. It isn't going to happen. And those among the Israelis who think that somehow the Palestinians can be uprooted and move somewhere else are just as wrong. That's not going to happen. So they're there side by side, and they can either live side by side in conflict or in peace. And to me, it's quite clear what the choice should be, and I urge them to implement the recommendations of our committee's report, which begins with a first step of an immediate and unconditional cessation of violence and a resumption of security cooperation, a report which both of them have praised and supported and endorsed. I and the members of my committee have been heartened by the response to our report. Everybody's for it, but we've been disheartened by the absence of any action toward its implementation. So I would urge them to do what they've said is right, and that is implement the recommendations in our report.
Senator George Mitchell, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
George Mitchell is the former Senate Majority Leader and United States Senator from Maine. I spoke to him earlier today from his law office in Washington. According to British journalist Robert Fisk, there is no international coalition and no true war on terror, just America's war on America's enemies. Do Americans, he asks, really understand the mess they're in? Fisk joins us now from Rawalpindi, near Islamabad in Pakistan. He's currently the Middle East correspondent for the London Independent. Since 1976, Fisk has been in and out of nearly every country and conflict in the region. Welcome, Robert Fisk.
Thank you. Hi.
Hi. We know how early it is there. Thanks for rising before dawn. And also with us in the studios of Vermont Public Radio is our special coverage news analyst, Jack Beattie, a senior editor of the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hi.
Here's the question. Are Americans ready for Robert Fisk's hard truths about the war on terror? Is Washington painting a realistic picture of the situation we're in? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Robert Fisk, we read your bold coverage in The Independent, and it seems as though someone's in an alternate universe here. You say, for starters, that there isn't even a global war on terrorism. What do you mean by that?
Well, first of all, it's not a war on terrorism. If it was a war on terrorism, the United States would be bombing the ETA separatists in northern Spain. Euskadi Te Askatasuna is what ETA means. The United States would be bombing Irish villages, which hold members of the real IRA who have not gone along with the ceasefire in Northern Ireland, which, of course, Senator Mitchell had a lot to do with. If it was a war on terror, the United States would be bombing also the Tamil Tigers, the suicide bombers of the Tamil Tigers in Jaffna in northern Sri Lanka. The United States would be bombing a whole slew of terrorist organizations around the world, but it's not. It's bombing Afghanistan, it's bombing the Taliban, it's bombing al-Qaeda of Osama bin Laden. This is a war against America's enemies, and we shouldn't be persuading ourselves, and the United States shouldn't be persuading itself, that it's going on any kind of crusade, to use the unfortunate word that George Bush began with weeks ago now, against world terror, moral evil, or anything else. Furthermore, this is not a coalition. There are no Saudi or Kuwaiti or Muslim pilots flying in the skies over Afghanistan as there were over Iraq in 1991, when the West, as a real coalition, was driving Saddam Hussein's forces out of Kuwait. There are only American pilots over Afghanistan, plus a few British missiles from British submarines in the Gulf. There are no Pakistani pilots, no Uzbek pilots, no Saudi pilots. This is an American war against America's enemies with a few local Muslim dictators backing, for the moment at least, this particular campaign, along with the British, with the moral support at the moment of the European Union and a few other nations. But there's no coalition, and it's not a war on terror.
Let's just pick those two things up first, though. I mean, surely, even in practical terms, no one wants to be bombing villages in Ireland right now. And as far as the coalition goes, President Bush says that people are contributing in many ways, some overt, some covert. You don't buy that?
Well, I'd like to see the coalition forces. All we see are American aircraft over Afghanistan. We know they're taking off from air bases in Uzbekistan, where a dictator called Islam Karimov has 7,000 political prisoners, no free press, and no opposition. We know that the Americans are using air bases in Pakistan, where General Musharraf, who recently appointed himself president, staged a coup d'etat in 1999 against the democratically elected Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif. We know the Americans want to use, but apparently at the moment still cannot use, the Prince Sultan Air Base outside Riyadh, capital of Saudi Arabia, our ally, British as well as American ally, which is a theocracy, an autocracy, where women have no equal rights, women can't even drive cars, where people have their hands chopped off, or indeed their heads chopped off, on Fridays after prayers, after trials, which are in many cases a mockery of international law. That's not a coalition. This is a war against America's enemies. It may well be a justified war, certainly in America's terms, perhaps in international terms, because what happened on September the 11th was a crime against humanity. I'm surprised that President Bush only called it a crime against humanity two or three days ago. Until then, it was a terrorist crime.
Robert Fisk, hold it there. We're going to break in just a second. Before we do, Jack Beatty, there's a larger critique here we know Robert Fisk has to deliver, but your first response?
Well, I mean, there is an incantational quality to the coalition. I think he's absolutely right. I mean, we're almost sort of getting their permission to wage this war, and it takes the form of saying, well, we're not going to denounce you in the United Nations. But we're getting a little bit more from that from some places, from Russia, for example, Uzbekistan. But in general, I mean, this is a very it is our show. It is our country that was hurt, and we are prosecuting a war against our enemy. That's certainly true. We've qualified it. We've said we're against terrorists of global reach. Well, that sort of leaves the IRA and ETA out and so on. But it is true that there is this sort of notional character of our coalition.
Jack, we've got to take a quick break. We're talking about a contrarian view of almost everything that's going on right now. Robert Fisk says it's not truly a war on terror, and he says also the war's not going so very well. We'll come to that. Do you accept, do you support Washington's design of this war? Are we on the right track or badly off? We're at 1-800-423-8255. You can also join us at WBUR.org. Click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour with Robert Fisk, Middle East correspondent for the London Independent. He's a harsh critic of U.S. policy in the Middle East and of the war that's on right now. He joins us from Rawalpindi, Pakistan. We're also joined by Jack Beattie, our Special Coverage news analyst. What do you think? Is there truth in Robert Fisk's view that we are not really engaged in a war on terror, just a war on America's enemies? Do you buy that? We're at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Robert Fisk, if you would for a moment, because I know that you've got a long view here, apart from this immediate critique, step back and give us your view of the regional and historical framework in which the U.S. is prosecuting this war.
This is tough. This is tough question at 5 o'clock in the morning here in Pakistan.
We know you're up to it.
You mean you hope I am.
We hope.
Look, first of all, I think let's look at the promises we're making. We're promising now, Mr. Bush is saying he's always had a vision of a Palestinian state. It would have been more impressive if we'd heard about that vision before September 11th, but we're told he has a vision. British Prime Minister Tony Blair says he wants a viable Palestinian state with East Jerusalem as a capital. We didn't hear that before September 11. U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell arrives very close to here in Islamabad October 16 and tells General, now President, Pervez Musharraf of Pakistan he really wants to deal with the Kashmir crisis. We're back in the same old game of promising the result, the answer to historical injustices, just when we need these people, the Muslims I'm talking about, on our side. Way back in the 1914 war, the First World War, in which my father was just old enough to fight as a soldier in 1918, we made similar promises in the Middle East. We told the Jews of the world that Britain would support a Jewish homeland in Palestine, and we told the Arabs that they would be given independence if they fought on our western side against the Ottoman Turks, against the greatest Muslim empire in the First World War. And we betrayed both. When it came to the state of Israel, we didn't, at the end of the day, support an Israeli state in all of Palestine, and we didn't offer, after the First World War, the Arabs real independence. We had the League of Nations, and we, the victors of the First World War, primarily the superpowers of the time, Britain and France, chopped up the states of the Middle East to our own liking and with their own vulnerable borders, which we gave them, and we ruled the Middle East. The British ruled Palestine, Iraq, the French ruled and much of the Gulf. The French ruled Syria, which they chopped up and made into Syria and Lebanon.
So you're saying we're still living with this today, but what can we do about it? It's what we've inherited.
Well, I don't necessarily think that the inheritance which we get from our fathers has to be left as it is. We can do things with it. You know, Senator Mitchell, I was listening to him very carefully there, and he's a very good man. And because I was partly educated in Ireland, I think he's a very fine man. I think he's done a wonderful thing in Northern Ireland. I think he's brought the world a long way to seeing a real peace there. But he's being a bit too gracious. The situation in Northern Ireland cannot be compared to the Middle East. What happened in Northern Ireland originally was that the British were on the side of the Unionist Protestants and the Americans were on the side of the Republican Catholics. And as the time went by, the Americans withdrew their support from violence, i.e. the IRA, and the British withdrew their support generally from the Protestants. Not enough and not totally, but by and large they did.
So take us to the Middle East.
Well, in the Middle East, it's not the same situation at all. The Arabs are largely without friends, whereas the world's greatest superpower, your country, the United States, is a virtually uncritical supporter of Israel. It is impossible to expect the Palestinians and the Israelis to reach a Northern Ireland-type peace when you have the one superpower in the world giving virtually uncritical support to one of the two parties in the dispute. That is not the case in Northern Ireland. It is the case in the Middle East. As long as America remains an uncritical supporter of Israel, and this is not to say that Israel doesn't have its points, doesn't have the right to exist, of course it does, but as long as the United States remains the virtually uncritical supporter of Israel, as long as we have Israeli tanks firing into civilian areas and U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell referring to his very close, dear friend, Ariel Sharon, which he did in the last 24 hours, you're not going to have a peace in the Middle East.
Jack Beatty, what do you make of that calculus?
Well, I mean, we're tied to Israel by all kinds of bonds, and some of them go even beyond the limits of national interest, crudely calculated. At the time when Israel was founded, George Kennan and other realists in the State Department argued against President Truman's recognition of Israel. They said that our material interests lie with the Arab states. They have the oil. Israel is a moral commitment, and that just doesn't cut it in the world. But there's a lot to that commitment, and it is a commitment that stems from the horrors of what Christianity perpetrated in Europe against the Jewish people over thousands of years. Amos Elon, the Israeli writer, uses this analogy. He says the Middle East is like a burning house. Picture a burning house, and the man in the window jumps out and he lands on a pedestrian. Mm. The fellow that jumped out is the Holocaust survivor. The fellow he landed on was the Arab. It is a tragedy.
Robert Fisk, Jack Beatty, stand by. I want to get callers in. We've got a lot piling up who want to join the conversation. We're talking about Robert Fisk's contrarian view of the war on terrorism, in fact, of the entire U.S. posture in the Middle East, maybe even the history. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Are we on the right track or badly off course already? Robert is on the line. Welcome, Robert. You're on the air.
Hi, it's Robert from Lexington.
Good to have you.
Yeah, I just don't think Mr. Fisk's critique is really very fair. I think the U.S. has been quite critical of Israel in a number of cases. We've certainly pushed to create a viable Palestinian state, and that's been the United States position for at least 5 years.
Yes.
Furthermore, I think that much of the problem comes from the Arabs focusing on this as a means for avoiding dealing with problems in their own country.
And Robert, what about Robert Fisk's broader point that we're not fighting a true war on terror, just a war against our own enemies?
We're fighting all terrorism. That's much too big a problem to tackle.
Well, we came pretty darn close to it.
Jack Beatty made the point earlier, and is quite correct, that we said we were going after terrorism with global reach, which at least cuts the problem down to something that's vaguely manageable.
So you're saying
the
we need to be
problem as it is.
You're saying we need to be realistic here, and you don't hear that in Robert Fisk's analysis?
No, I don't. I think it's unfair. I think it's a sort of a damned if we do and damned if we don't.
Let's put it to the early rising man in Pakistan, Robert Fisk. How about it? Our caller Robert says you're not being realistic.
Well, look, it could be said, and indeed many Americans have said, that the Lebanese Hezbollah, which ended its days, if it's not ended now, I think it's a political force, as a resistance movement against Israel, has, according to the United States State Department, carried out a number of terrorist acts under the U.S. State Department's definition in Latin America against Jewish targets in Latin America. There's global reach for you, but I don't see the United States bombing the Bekaa Valley in Lebanon. I don't think they're going to because they want Lebanon and ultimately Syria on the U.S. side in some form of future peace agreement. So again, even the global reach definition doesn't work. I think that, you know, after the events of September the 11th, I remember I was actually crossing the Atlantic on an aircraft on September 11th, and I realized something had gone wrong when I saw the sun coming through the wrong side of the aircraft, the passenger cabin, and realized we'd turn around. And when I got back to Europe and saw those pictures, I was, as I'm sure your caller and your callers plural are, awed by the sheer evil of what happened. It's essential, I think, to start off on one common platform here. What happened in Washington and New York was a crime against humanity. It's a pity, as I said, that President Bush has only just started using that phrase. We ought to be setting up tribunals, international courts, ready to deal with the perpetrators of these crimes against humanity. But nonetheless, all of us, I think, as human beings, and that applies to Muslims too, and I'm not a Muslim, but I've talked to Pakistanis, Afghans, Lebanese, Syrians, Egyptians. I live in the Middle East. All of them were appalled at the sheer wickedness of this crime.
But Robert Fisk, we accept that as your starting point and as ours, but you've written that the United States is then not pursuing a just response. What do you mean?
Correct.
What do you mean by that?
Look, the United States is doing what it did in the Gulf. It's doing what it did in the anti-Yugoslav war over Kosovo in 1999. It's starting off with what it calls surgical strikes, and then it's continuing to bang away at countries which ultimately cannot defend themselves against a superpower and are not intended to. And it is doing so without any long-term policy. What are we really doing in Afghanistan? This is a country which is one of the poorest in the world. It is already ruined by 22 years of war. Every day, between 20 and 25 people are blown up by landmines left behind by the Russians, the other superpower, which is now, thank God, disintegrated.
But our leaders say we're clearing out a nest of terrorists.
But we're not. How many terrorists have the United States caught? How many people have we put into court so far? How many legal charges have we already framed? We need, you know, after Srebrenica, let's hold on a second, just hold on. After Srebrenica, this appalling human massacre in eastern Bosnia in 1995, which took the lives of 7,000 humans. My God, at least the Serbs tried to sort out the men to murder and not the women and children. Let's look at the nature of the evil of what happened on September the 11th. After this, we set up, we already had, but we used a massive and very intricate and intellectual system of justice to pull the people responsible out of their countries and put them on trial. And we're doing it even now as I speak to you.
At the Hague.
At the Hague. Why don't we have a tribunal? Why don't we have international courts ready to deal with the crimes against humanity in New York and Washington? Because we, by which I suppose I mean the United States, prefers to bomb poor old Afghanistan in the hope that out of the hat will come our latest hate figures. You know, the leaders of the Taliban, Osama bin Laden, his Egyptian cohorts, whatever they may be, always assuming they're responsible. And I must admit, they look as if they are.
Jack Beatty, let me put that to you. Robert Fisk is saying he agrees it's a crime against humanity, but we're not pursuing justice in a just fashion.
Well, it's hard to fight a war that is going to be just in its conduct. I mean, the Second World War was shot through every moment of it with vast human cruelty and injustice on all sides. But in the end, it was a just cause. And the effort to protect ourselves against our enemies who reside in somewhere in the caves and hills of Afghanistan is a legitimate act of state. There is no country in the world that would have allowed this kind of thing to happen without pursuing, insofar as they can and with respect to other values, the perpetrators. And that's what we're doing there. I'm not going to defend bombing these people. I think it's counterproductive. I think that but the model of Yugoslavia is not really quite apposite, because there was a use of force that was necessary to get Milosevic to crack, to get that regime to break.
Robert
that
Fisk?
Was an important part of the whole...
Look, just two very brief things. First of all, as I say in every conversation where we have any discussion of the Middle East or anything else, this is not the Second World War. I'm sorry, I did 7 years of my PhD thesis on the Second World War. This is not the Second World War.
I didn't say that it was. I just said that the Second World War was full of irrationality and cruelty, but ultimately justified.
Yeah, taken. But let me add one other thing. You point out that the bombing of Afghanistan is counterproductive. That is not the problem. The problem with the bombing of Afghanistan is that it is immoral because it is killing innocent people, people just as innocent as those who were so savagely slaughtered in the World Trade Center in Washington on September 11.
Now, there's a line.
Did you take the same line in Yugoslavia, the bombing in Kosovo?
Yes, I did. I was in Serbia for the 11 weeks of the NATO bombardment, and I saw young Serbian women beheaded by NATO bombs. I thought that the bombing of Albanian refugee convoys, because we wouldn't allow our pilots to fly low enough to risk their lives to make sure they had the right targets, was utterly immoral. I thought that NATO was immoral because it, first of all, started a war against the Serbs because of Milosevic's cruel treatment of the Albanians, Albanian Muslims. And then once the war had started and the people were being ethnically cleansed. We then said that the war was to get the people of Albania and Kosovo back into their homes, even though most of them were in their homes when we started the war.
Robert
it was
Fisk,
utterly immoral.
Jack Beatty, let us turn to the callers. There are a lot of them who want to join the conversation. We're trying to step through the moral labyrinth of this new war on terrorism. Robert Fisk says we're getting it all wrong. What do you think? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Sultan is calling from Salem, New Hampshire. Welcome, Sultan.
Yeah, hi, how are you?
We're well, thanks.
I just got a question, comment. When I see the read the newspaper and the other media, isn't it that, you know, our American right, you know, on the political spectrum is also kind of to expand the war to other places for their own political and religious feeling.
You're saying it's a right-wing American political push?
They want to expand it as long as they can, as much as they can.
But to what end? To what end, Sultan? Why would they want to do that?
For their own political contempt for religious grounds, for national grounds. I mean, the people like, if you read, I'm sure you read that, people like William Safire, Jeff Jacoby, Steve Emerson, or these guys.
Conservatives.
People from Hudson Institute or Heritage Institute, read them. They're all one line. You know, let's go for it. Let's destroy them. Let's bomb them. Let's do this. Let's attack Iraq now.
Sultan, let's put it to Robert Fisk.
You know, it's gone on and on. It seems like, you know, the whole agenda is just expanded. Just let's kind of they got their moment to take their, you know, passions out.
We take your point, but let's put it to Robert Fisk. Sultan is saying this looks like a right-wing agenda, but you know, sitting in the United States, it looks like a fairly broad consensus around what's going on right now, Robert Fisk. Does that surprise you?
Well, I won't tell you what it feels like to sit in Pakistan at 5:30 and hear a voice from Salem. Look, I think we need to sort something out here. This is not, I think, a war really on religious grounds. I'm going to put in a brief and perhaps unexpected feather here in for the United States. You know, America has spent a lot of time, I hate to use this cliche, coming to terms. This is the sort of psychobabble I loathe, but coming to terms with the issue of the Unabomber. Mm-hmm. And the issue of Timothy McVeigh. Let's talk about American terrorism. I think it's worth pointing out that Muslims in general have not tried to deal with the issue of September the 11th, of real violence against innocent people. I don't think that the Muslim world as a whole, it has condemned September 11th. It has been awed by the wickedness of it. I think genuinely so. I have many good friends throughout the Middle East. I don't even think of what their religion is, but most of them, of course, are Muslim, who just put their hands in front of their mouths and said, I cannot believe such appalling, wicked behavior. But I don't think the Muslim world has attempted to deal with the bin Ladens in a theological or moral way. They have accepted that people like bin Laden talk about injustices in the Middle East, which they do, and they are real injustices, which is why our leaders are running around like rabbits trying to solve them very quickly with fake promises, in my view. But they have not, the Muslim world has not tried to say, hang on a second, how can we produce these people who will fly airplanes, 19 people, and commit suicide all at the same time, knowing the innocent passengers, knowing what they're doing. So I think that when I listen to your listener in Salem, my feeling is, hang on a second, I'd like to know if Sultan really feels that the Muslim world is examining itself, as it should, even though it is the victim of great historical injustice, which I think is real.
Robert Fisk, we've got
to
take another.
The Muslim world, why hasn't, much more important, why hasn't the Muslim world started to ask itself, how can we produce people who wish such appalling crimes to happen?
Robert Fisk, we've got to come back to it. We'll take a quick break. We're talking about a contrarian view of the war going on right now with Robert Fisk, Middle East correspondent for the London Independent. What do you think? Are we on track or not? Are there changes that we should make even now? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour with Robert Fisk, Middle East correspondent for the London Independent and a sharp critic of U.S. policy right now in the Middle East. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Robert Fisk, we just have a few minutes before we've got to take off here, but let me ask you this. We hear you that you're saying it's not an honest war on terror. we may or may not agree. We hear you when you're saying it's not a just response to September 11th. We can also debate that. But let us ask you, in America's own terms, how is this war going from your perspective?
Well, it's not going anywhere at the moment because we already have Mr. Bush telling us it could take weeks, it could take months, it could take years. Indeed, he said a decade. That was a pretty awesome comment, which he hadn't thought through. America can't afford, either financially or morally, 10 years of war, either in Afghanistan or anywhere else. Secondly, what are we really trying to do? If it's a question of bringing to justice the perpetrators of the crimes against humanity of September 11, then let's have the courts and let's have the evidence and let's put these people through the punishment they deserve. If what we're doing is carrying out a war against America's enemies to make sure that people can't bomb America or damage America or destroy American lives or lives of human beings in America in future, then we should say that that's what it is. And then we should ask ourselves why we're bombing a country where within a few weeks, 3 weeks it'll be winter, 2 weeks it'll be Ramadan, we're going to have a tragedy of potentially biblical proportions, famine, starvation, death on our hands, tens of thousands of people, a numerical figure that will far outweigh the appalling and awesome number of deaths of September 11. Are we preparing for that? Are we there to save lives? Are we really trying to set up a new nation in Afghanistan? Are we trying to perhaps in some unconscious way repair the sins which we committed when, having supported the Afghans against the Russians for 10 years of Soviet occupation, we then left them high and dry and abandoned them to their country of 10 million landmines?
We practically say that we're there to do all that, but maybe we're just not seeing it the same way. What do you think of U.S. media coverage of this effort so far, to the extent that you have access to it?
Yes, I'm glad you say that. I try to keep myself away from American media coverage as much as possible.
Why?
Because it's the same as it was in the Gulf War. It's the same as it was in Yugoslavia in 1999. It is basically sheep-like. Look, I have many American colleagues, and they're good friends of mine, and some of them share my views, although, strangely enough, they don't seem to share it when it comes to writing their stories. I think there is in the United States, and I give lectures in America very, very often, almost on average once every 5 weeks until something like September 11th happens. The United States, I think people have a feeling that to start criticizing foreign policy, particularly if it is affected by the question of Israel, is somehow subversive and anti-patriotic, and they won't do so. There has been built up a kind of facade of acceptance of foreign policy in the Middle East region, supported by the language of the State Department, CNN, if you like, where Israel is the good guy, the Arabs are the bad guys, Hollywood, of course, supports that. Where once you start criticizing United States policy, and I've noticed this very recently in radio programs, chat shows like this one, in various radio stations, the moment you start criticizing the United States, you are seen as a critic of Israel, therefore you are seen as being racist, anti-Semitic, and immoral. And most Americans, I find, which is a total lie, it's not true, it's a smear to claim that journalists are anti-Semitic or racist, but most Americans are not prepared to make any serious criticism of the Middle East. You know, Senator Mitchell, when he was talking earlier and when we were discussing him, the one issue we left out is that there is a very, very powerful pro-Israeli lobby in the United States.
Robert Fisk, we've just got to jump, but you always make...
I bet we have. Yes,
no, we are at the end of our time. Yeah. We take your points, all of them. They're on the air. You always make us think twice, and we appreciate it. We're going to check back in with you and your view of all that's going on. Thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Robert Fisk is Middle East correspondent for the London Independent. He's been covering the Middle East since 1976. Jack Beatty, it really makes you sit up and listen when Robert Fisk speaks, agree or not.
Well, he's a man who's reported on that part of the world for years. He knows the people. He clearly has a feeling for them. And he's telling us that this bombing in Afghanistan is not only counterproductive, I was speaking in very limited terms, but it's a ghastly thing to do, to punish these people this way. The trouble is that this regime there has put its arms around a man who's killed about 6,000 Americans. Mm. And I don't know what we do. I mean, yes, an international court would be wonderful, but you've got to get him to the court. You've got to apprehend him. And to do that, you've got to put some pressure on the government that's harboring him. I don't see any way around that. Now, perhaps there's a better way to do it than bombing. I want there to be. I think millions of Americans do. We're all sickened by this. But we don't see it right now.
Jack, we're out of time here. It's great to have you back. We'll have another night to talk through it all. Thanks so much for being with us.
Okay.
You can read recent articles written by Robert Fisk on our website. Log on to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage. Each night this week, we're looking at the literature of and about Afghanistan, what it reveals about the character and culture of the Afghan people. We've looked at the ancient tradition of storytelling, the great classics, and contemporary Afghan literature. Tonight, the emergence of women writers.
Where is the ear to hear my cries? Where is the eye to see my tears? I am the ashes of a hopeless fire. Where is the wind to refresh my flames? I am a silent dervish sitting in the cell of my grief. Where is the flute to sing my sorrows?
Under the Taliban, women have all but disappeared from public life inside Afghanistan. They've been enveloped by the veils of the burqa, denied education and reproductive health care. But Afghan women living outside the country are speaking up in fiction and poetry. Joining us now is Fawzia Raghazar Barlas. She's an Afghan poet and writer. Her latest collection of poetry is called The Heavens Are My Father. She teaches Persian at the University of Washington. Welcome, Fawzia Raghazar Barlas.
Thank you for having me in your program.
We hear a lot about the trials of Afghan women in recent years, under the Taliban in particular, not to mention the years of war before that. How active are Afghan women in writing? Is there anything going on inside Afghanistan? And if not, is there a center?
Well, inside Afghanistan, there's nothing. Just I can tell you that. Nothing. No voice, no writing at all. But women outside of Afghanistan, they're the sort of active. But still, the number of women who are involved in writing are very, very limited. And especially in respect with poetry and short story writings, we don't have. Because we don't have that many publications outside the country to raise their voice and to invite their participation in these things.
So women writing today are, first of all, writing in exile, and secondly, is it a revolutionary act to write as an Afghan woman?
Yes. As much as I understand, it looks to be, because inside Afghanistan, they're totally silenced. But outside, when they look around, they learn from the society they live, especially in West. And so they try to join and they try to share the agony of women who live inside Afghanistan. And they find the encouragement to express themselves and to be something.
As we opened our conversation, you read a lovely poem with the image of a woman turning like a silent dervish. What are you suggesting there, Fawzia?
Well, actually, I wrote this poem when I heard the massacre of an entire village in the north of Afghanistan, that the people who simply couldn't speak Pashto. Mm-hmm. And then I said, is there anybody to really listen to these people? And I just wanted to be their voice, and I just wanted to be the voice of those women who had nothing to do. So I look at myself like a dervish who just has a world inside and cannot express myself.
And for those of us who don't know Afghan culture as well, a dervish is a mystic in the Afghan culture.
Definitely, and it's a very, very strong image in our culture. And dervish is also the symbol of purification, the symbol of love and peace and the purity of spirit and soul. So when I use the word of dervish, I mean everything. That, okay, I am clean, I am fresh, I have so many things to offer. But if nobody listens to me, if nobody sees my tears, then what can I do? Just I need really a flute to express myself. And this flute maybe can be my poetry, can be my writing. Not only me, actually. I'm talking about women, yeah.
The themes of suffering, misery, agony, you've said come up often when Afghan women write.
That's right. If I speak about me, I'm a love poet. But this is inevitable nowadays. When you look, when you hear, when you watch, everything is pain. So that's why I dedicated my last two collections only to the voice of women and children in Afghanistan.
When you write about love, Fawzia Raghazar Barlas, mm-hmm. how do the current circumstances of Afghanistan affect that line of writing?
When sexuality and stuff is involved, I try to avoid it. But still I have the voice to say, okay, my body can be tortured, but my spirit is so free. And that's why when I say heavens or my father, I just try to say that, okay, my body is the earth, but I can fly in the sky so freely. I mean, that's why in one of my poems, when I say, I am in love, I am in love, I am in love, you, the parched pieces of my body, you, the unfelt freedom of my senses, grow hot, boiling, steaming, for I am the fire, I am the fire, I am the fire. This is only when I describe that as a woman, I am the air, I am the fire. And then, of course, I express my own desires for a man or for love or whatever.
The writer always carries some responsibility to speak for their culture, but you must feel it especially heavily in your case when Afghans and especially women have no voice.
Oh, definitely, yes. But this is the part that when I think about the history of Afghanistan, at least the recent history that I witnessed, I cannot blame only men. I'm not talking about Taliban, of course. I'm mm-hmm. talking about the history. Mm-hmm. And then I see that women in Afghanistan never fought in their rights. There has never been any kind of organized movement for women issues. Mm-hmm. And so they must be also blamed for that silence. I read so many books to find if there has been any kind of movements for women freedom and stuff. They were very local, very weak, very disorganized. That was it.
Do you see signs in the writing of Afghan women today that that might change?
Well, I think so. I received some magazines from Canada and from Pakistan, where so many women are living there. And I feel that now they seem very precise and they want to raise their voices. But the very huge problem that I believe at the moment I witness is the kind of language barrier. They cannot introduce themselves in the languages of the countries that they live. For example, in Germany, I met hundreds of them, and in France. And so they can express themselves only in Persian. And Persian, how many publications do we have in Persian?
Not too many.
Yes.
We think of the suffering that's gone on in Afghanistan, but you write of Kabul, the capital, as the sweet city of my sweet memories. How long has it been since you lived there, and what's the image that you're referring to?
I raised in a very wealthy and highly educated family, and I'm from Mazar-e-Sharif, from north of Afghanistan. Mm. And so it is 27 years that I left Afghanistan, and I was only a teenager. But of course, at that time, the war was not still there. But when I remember my own childhood, and then I remember the very painful moments of today's children in Afghanistan, I can never compare the Afghanistan that I saw, the Afghanistan that I enjoyed, and the kind of liberal Islam that my family were experiencing around me.
Do you see room for hope?
Oh, definitely. Maybe I can say that very bravely, that when I heard America is sending troops, I said, oh, America, I love you. I know that you will take freedom there. And I will see that women will walk again in the street and children will go back to school. I'm very optimistic and very hopeful.
You've written a short story called Princess of Waltzes. It's based on the true story of a war victim that you met in Vienna in 1995. I'd like to ask you to read just the conclusion of that story. This is where the woman in exile is 3 months out of Kabul. She's now in Vienna. Could you read that for us?
Okay. She came closer to the mirror, removed the dust from the surface with her elegant hands, and at the very depth of her silent and gloomy eyes, she saw a fantastic dream. A pretty princess was laughing heavenly in the secured arms of her father. Waltzes were flying beyond the ancient walls of Vienna towards the boundless blue skies, and there, in that white and peaceful top of the sky, nobody was in captivity of the walls of the sanitarium. A litter? Not at all.
Fawzia Raghazar Barlas, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It was a great pleasure for me.
Fawzia Raghazar Barlas is an Afghan poet and writer. She's lived in exile for more than 20 years. Her most recent book of poetry is called The Heavens Are My Father. Tomorrow, we end our series on Afghan literature with a discussion on Rudyard Kipling and the perspective of Western writers on Afghanistan. You can learn more about Afghan literature and listen to other installments in the series by going to our website, log on to WBUR.org, and click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR, Boston.